portion of the docket. It's McDougal versus Levick and Levick versus McDougal. Good morning. These are consolidated cases, and there are 20 minutes per side. So I'm happy to allocate that time, but is there a way that you would prefer to proceed in terms of breaking down that 20 minutes per side? I mean, we could do 15, 25, we could do 15, 15, 5, 5, for example.
Yes. I would prefer the 15, 5, 5.
All right. Is that agreeable? All right. Well, why don't we start with the first case that, as it appears in the docket, Mr. Cottrell, would you be arguing?
Yes.
Okay. All right. So we'll do that. You have 15 minutes, so we'll be happy to hear from you.
Thank you. I'm James Ray Cottrell, Cottrell, Fletcher, Shinstock, Bartol, and Cottrell in Alexandria, and it's my privilege to represent Deborah McDougal in this appellate proceeding. Our principal contention in this domestic relations case is that the lower court erred in declaring a marriage of over 10 years' duration void ab initio when the parties, first, fully intended to be married, secondly, were legally eligible to be married, third, had a marriage ceremony, four, had a valid marriage license issued to them, fifth, followed the instructions of a licensed officiate of this commonwealth to communicate their desire to marry after the license was issued by sending the license to him. Six, the marriage license was signed by the officiant and recorded in the state register. They consummated the marriage. They believed themselves to be lawfully married at all times, and they behaved as a married couple for over 10 years, including 2 years of fierce divorce litigation in the Circuit Court of Fairfax County. Now, there were numerous opportunities, we contend, for the court to meet Virginia's very strong public policy to uphold marriage status for the best interests of society, except where marriage is prohibited between certain persons. That is the standard set by Needham versus Needham. Now, in examining what it is that the court did and did not do, and where along the way it might have been able to have avoided this drastic result, resulting in a manifest injustice, especially to my client, who, of course, was denied all the benefits of having been married to Mr. Levick, while he retained all the benefits of having been married to her. We feel first that the court erred in permitting Mr. Levick to amend his answer and countercomplaint to ask for an annulment.
Yeah, I mean, the problem there is it's a discretionary call, and so maybe we would have made a different call.
I understand, Your Honor, but...
There's a number of cases where the court refused to permit amendment that go either way. But when the court grants, I mean, are there cases where there's been a reversal there?
I would normally agree with the court entirely, except because of the unique circumstances of this case, and that's this. Here we had a situation where they had to proffer, and they had actually filed a motion before the amended pleadings were permitted, in which they set forth their basis for attempting to set aside the marriage as being void ab initio. So the court had an opportunity to consider exactly what it was that they wanted to present. And our view is that under Needham, if it was not a prohibited marriage, and if it had already been admitted to the state register under a valid license that had been signed by an officiant of the Commonwealth, that would not be sufficient. There's a prima facie presumption that the marriage is correct. And for someone to come in and say, basically, what we're going to argue to the court is the sufficiency of solemnization in this marriage, it's almost as if you're saying, I should be able to look behind the license in every case and violate the very purpose of the state register as a reliable source for who's married and not married in order to find out whether the right foot was in front of the left foot. In other words, the more subjective basis on which a trial judge might...
Does that get to Judge McCullough's question about the basic issue of allowing the amendment of the pleadings. Why should we as an appellate court say to the trial court here, you really abused your discretion? Because that is the standard, right?
I agree that that's the standard, and I won't spend more time on it except to say that we make essentially the same argument when you get to marriage by estoppel and the estoppel aspects of the case. And I do like the reasoning that Judge Hal Brown had in his circuit court decision, McKea versus Kundra, in which after taking evidence in a case like this, he simply said, I will not look behind the license, and he explained his reasons for that. We cite to that, and I think that you might be able to create a rule of law. And the rule that I would like to see, and that I'm arguing to
but
the
would
court,
that, I mean, it seems like the thrust of these older cases is Virginia, from an early date in its history, was dead set against common law marriages. Now, we do have a license here.
Yes.
So that takes us out of that.
Yes.
Does that then eliminate, as a practical matter, the solemnization piece of this?
I don't know that it eliminates the solemnization. Here's what the problem is. If you look at 20-13, it doesn't define solemnization. And the only reference that anyone has cited to for what solemnization is really just two cases. There's Alexander versus Kirkendall that says, well, you're not allowed to prescribe a particular form of solemnization. We understand that. And then we have an unpublished case where Judge Kelsey said, in the context of a bigamy case, that we don't know what solemnization means, but it at least requires the appearance before the officiant of the two people are getting married. Well, I don't know that that's so. And I don't know if that should be so. We offered an alternative suggestion on solemnization because the court shouldn't get into the business of interfering with the discretion of the parties as to how they will solemnize their marriage. And that is that after the license has been issued, all that should be required is a communication to the officiant that you do indeed want to be married. And we believe that occurred in this case.
Because if you have the ceremony first, and you're not arguing there doesn't have to be something ahead of time in this case, right? Some sort of...
What ahead of what, Your Honor? I'm sorry.
That something before whoever is licensed to marry them, at least are you arguing that the husband and wife, bride and groom, don't need to at least appear together before the person?
I'm not trying to set a new policy at all. I'm saying under the facts of this case, I think that was done, either as we've suggested through
Can
part
I
of
ask
the
you then on that,
process.
If you wait to get the license or have the license signed and submitted,
yes.
In this case, almost a month later, not quite a month later, but where is the cutoff period? If this is enough, why isn't 6 months later enough?
Because the statute says 60 days.
Right.
The communication would have to be made within 60 days, and the subsequent statute says that the license is good for the 60-day period.
60 days before or after the license is
well,
gone.
Well, remember, as we have construed it to the court here, they had a formal ceremony in front of people before they got the license.
That under any standard would be solemnization.
Yes, of course. That would clearly be a solemnization through anything. However, it was known to the officiant and to the parties that there was no license, and the officiant then directed someone licensed by the Commonwealth of Virginia that they solve the problem by sending him the license, going and getting the license, and then he would sign it. Now, we've suggested to the court that there are two possible interpretations of that. The first would be that since the statute's not expressly ordinal, we shouldn't take a narrow view. We should take a more expansive view to meet Virginia's public policy of trying to uphold the marriage whenever possible. And secondly, we've said this was part of a process, and that is what Ms. McDougall testified to. And I believe a fair reading of Rabbi Biber's testimony indicated that's what he thought it was, too. In other words, that I've had the ceremony, but when you send me the license, then I interpret that as, yes, indeed, we do want to be married, which satisfies, we would contend, every public purpose reason for requiring the licensing and the solemnization in this case.
There's some older cases, mostly out of state, but some in Virginia, that talk about this concept of ratification. And it's ordinarily in the context of someone who lacks mental capacity at the time they were married, or who was a older Virginia case where the guardian had arranged a marriage for this underage girl.
Yeah.
And the person then, when they're able to, can ratify and make good the previous marriage. Does that concept have any applicability here?
We didn't argue it in that way, but I suppose you could say that. But I prefer to look at it this way. If you construe the minimal requirement of solemnization advising the officiant who's going to sign the marriage license so it can be admitted to the state register that indeed you want to be married after a license has been issued, either completing the process or setting it up ahead of time where the officiant, remember the officiant here has the unspoken power. The parties came to him and said, what do we do? He's licensed by the Commonwealth. He tells them, do it this way. They complied with that. So they set up the communication means by which their final assent after the license had been issued would be made known to the officiant. Isn't that precisely what the statute is attempting to accomplish? On the other hand, we need to look at what happens if you interpret it in the way that the trial judge did. Now, that's where we have our major quarrel with the trial judge. I look carefully through Judge Bell's opinion, and he is absolutely one of the best jurists that we have in Fairfax County. I have no quarrel with him as a judge. I just don't agree with him here. And he said that there were three reasons why he wouldn't accept our argument. He said, if I were to accept this, individuals could have a ceremony but never get a license. Well, that doesn't apply here. We're not arguing that they don't have to have a license. If you don't have a license, you can't get married.
Right, and it's clear they would not have a valid marriage in Virginia.
That would be true. Secondly, he said, well, they could have a ceremony with the intent to get a license, but then change their minds. Well, that's true now. People can get a license and then change their mind about getting married, or they may lose track of time and they don't get married within 60 days. And then thirdly, he said, they could have a ceremony but then find out that they're prohibited from getting a license. Well, if they're prohibited from getting a license, they're not allowed to be married. I mean, that's what it means. We have our statutes, and part of what we were arguing in this case is that somehow Judge Bellows has construed this as a situation where the marriage would be void ab initio, which is absolutely extraordinary. And we do feel that there should be a rule law that says
I mean, this statute's been on the books probably since before Virginia's independence. I mean, it goes way, way back. I mean, in its basic essence.
Right.
Well, and how about the Offield case? It's a 1909 case.
Well, that deals with common law marriage.
Yes, and that was the basis for the statute.
It is interesting. I would say two things about the statute. First of all, when the statute was first created, I'm sure that the gentleman who's in the picture up here would have no trouble knowing exactly what it would mean to solemnize the marriage. It comes right out of the prayer book. But our society has changed, and so we know that the meaning of that word has changed, but nothing has been done by the General Assembly to tell us specifically what it is, and really not much from our courts as to tell us what's necessary. The reason we urge on the court the interpretation that the only public policy purpose of this solemnization event would be to let the officiant know, yeah, we do want to get married after the license is issued, so he can then sign it and send it in. Now, I do think it's interesting. Two of the out-of-state cases, Judge McCall, that we cited to, Young versus Young and Johnson v. Johnson, are also instructive. The Johnson case in particular, now that's a Tennessee case, but in their comment in upholding this marriage by estoppel, they made the comment that the formalities in the statute were mainly designed to give notoriety to the marriage and perpetuate evidence of the marriage. Well, we have a different way of doing it now.
Let me ask you this. Clearly, you need a license under Offield because we don't recognize common law marriages.
And we're not arguing for common law.
Right. And you clearly need solemnization. And but there's all those cases that go the other way that say all of these things are merely directory and not mandatory. Mm-hmm. Would it be possible to hold that solemnization's mandatory, licensing is mandatory, but the order is directory and not mandatory?
Yes, I think it would. In fact, we did argue that to the trial court. We said it's not ordinal because it should be expressed. And we did cite to other states where it's expressly ordinal. Some states even control the words that have to be said by the officiant.
So then we get into, well, what's the window? And you could have a solemnization 10 years prior, and then the license is issued 10 years later.
Well, remember, we're arguing, first of all, on the facts of this case.
Ophield, here we are 100 years later arguing about that precedent.
Well,
so I understand
you,
we're resolving
you could
this
say,
case.
But. You could say on this facts, on these facts for a variety of reasons. But as I've said, Judge McCullough, we are actually arguing for a rule of law that's different than that. What we would say is that, yes, you could have an earlier ceremony that might suit your religious taste or whatever, but you do have to indicate in some way with the officiant by prearrangement how you're going to communicate final assent. And we believe that that's...
Within the 60 days.
I'm sorry?
Within the 60
yes,
days.
Yes, within the 60 days, and that was done here.
Well, let me ask you about that, because 20-14.1 says every marriage license issued under 2014 shall constitute authority for a period of only 60 days from the date of issuance for the solemnization of a marriage of the licensees.
Mm-hmm.
And then whenever that 60-day period shall have elapsed, the license shall expire. It says from the date of issuance.
Right.
So that the solemnization must occur after.
Yes. And
what is the solemnization here then, other than mailing the license?
The solemnization is this. Just as we cannot tell them that they have to go through an Anglican service, which would be my preference, they cannot do that. People can say, all I want to do is tell you, we want to be married. And they're entitled to do that. If they went to the courthouse, saw the magistrate, said, I don't want to say any of those words.
So they
we want to be married.
They need to be together at the time.
Well, not necessarily. They just have to jointly indicate by some communication. Because we wouldn't want to deprive deaf and dumb people of the right to do it. And we wouldn't want blind people who can't be seen or cannot see the officiant to be without it. And we do want to be with modern times here. But remember, and I think
they
this makes the critical...
remotely, essentially.
I think there would have to be a critical difference. And in this case, the critical difference is that how is the ceremony completed? Remember, the ceremony started this way. The officiant told them what to do in order to comply with the law. They naturally did that. No one is alleging, there's not a scintilla of evidence here that these people were trying to get around the law for some nefarious purpose. They believed themselves to be married. And then they complied strictly with that. This wasn't an ex post facto, let's fix it. They were doing as they were instructed by the officiant who was licensed by the Commonwealth.
The problem is, misadvice of law is ordinarily not.
Well, that brings us to one of our other arguments, of course.
And you are about, and we've asked you a lot of questions. You're about 17 minutes in.
Oh, I'm sorry.
So it's up to you if you want to keep going.
I just want to mention two things, and that would be that I do think the Johnson case, the Young cases, are both instructive on marriage by estoppel. And I think marriage by estoppel has been recognized indirectly in extraordinary situations and should be in this Commonwealth in the same way that Dry versus Rice and McNear versus McNear recognized divorce essentially by estoppel. And I think that means that we are concerned about the equities of the situation. As in the Young case, the Missouri court said, the only reason that he's arguing this now is to keep her from getting what the law entitles her to, which was precisely what Mr. Levick did here. He wanted to get out of this agreement that it had even gotten to the point where he had waived all of his objections, which is another reason why we didn't think he should have been able to amend, because it was so far along in that. The other thing that we want to mention, and we don't want to unemphasize this, is that we believe that 20-31 applies fully, because if the officiate had a lack of authority to define how this was going to be repaired, in other words, his judgment was wrong on this, but they had a good faith belief that they were married, that's precisely what the statute is for. So the parties themselves are punished for the incompetence or the lack of authority of the official. And the same thing would be true of the license, because if he told them to go get a license, that would not be sufficient to have the ceremony be valid, because it preceded the license. If Judge Bellows is right on that it is ordinal, then it would be a defective license. And remember, he told them that's what to do. So we believe that the remedial portions of...
Did he absolutely assume that they would not do anything else after they got the license other than sign it and mail it to him?
As he said, mm-hmm. as he said, when he got it back, he said that he assumed they wanted to be married. I mean, it does create an act. Just like when someone says, I'm getting ready to walk in before the magistrate to get married here. Well, maybe I don't want to. Well, maybe I will. He goes in. That's the moment of truth. The moment of truth here is manifested differently. Well, we either send it in or we don't. The evidence is uncontested. They agreed to send it in. And they were complying with a previously agreed scheme and directive of the officiant. So we feel that means the remedial statute should be applied uncompromisingly for that purpose. I see my time is up. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. We asked you a lot of questions, and I think it's fair to say this is an extraordinary case, so you still have your rebuttal time.
Thank
you. Same with you. If we have a lot of questions for you, we'll...
Thank you,
we
Your
need
Honors.
To carefully.
May it please the court. I'm Edna Ruth Vincent, and I represent Richard Levick. I'm here with my co-counsel, okay. Colleen Haddo, from Holton, Cummins, Watson, and Vincent. Judge Bellows said it best. This is a case about a marriage ceremony without a marriage license, followed by a marriage license without
let
a ceremony.
Let me just dive right in. What, I mean, clearly Virginia wants solemnization, i.e., and the way I read that was to impress on people the importance of what they're about to undertake. And they also need a license because we don't like this informality of common law marriages. What is the harm of reversing the order as occurred here? And it may be that the plain language of the statute means you win regardless of the underlying policies. But I'm just trying to figure out what difference does it make if by a few weeks they flip the order.
Well, one of the differences is if you don't have a license, there is nothing to solemnize. If you solemnize first, maybe you have a common law marriage. But without the license, there is nothing of a civil nature to solemnize. And 20-13 is... very clear. The license comes first. And you can start by looking at the plain language of the statute. Look at the order of the words.
I didn't think that was as clear as the overall statutory picture. For example, the crime of celebrating under 20-28, for celebrating a marriage without a license, which is basically what occurred here.
I agree that when you look at the 2013, 2014.1 and the other surrounding statutes, it absolutely supports that you need a license first. 2014.1, the statute that authorizes the issuance of a license for the purpose of solemnization. The license is what gives the officiant the authority to solemnize within the 60-day period.
And here, I mean, you basically had this mix-up. Within a fairly short period and within the 60-day window, the parties clearly evince this intent to be married. Why couldn't they... unambiguously within that window ratify or manifest their intent to essentially have this prior solemnization be the solemnization?
Well, there's nothing in the statutory scheme or the case law that supports a relating back to solemnization that occurred before the license. As the court was pointing out in Oakville, this statute has been around since 1864, and the Oakville case in 1902 abolished common law marriage. That is very significant to Virginia's public policy.
But this, the license defeats any claim. It's a public document. Anybody can look it up. That's the key thing that defeats common law marriages. A solemnization is more of a historical artifact in a way, because the case law says There's no prescribed, and how could there be, no prescribed method of solemnization?
Well, they say there's no prescribed form of a ceremony, no prescribed form of solemnization, but it does mean there is something that has to happen. Solemnization means something. And in this case, we had a falsified marriage license where the rabbi said, I married you in McLean, Virginia, on a day when he really signed the license in Maryland, a license that was FedExed to him. The evidence was uncontroverted. The parties never met with the rabbi, never had any communication with the rabbi. Clearly, solemnization has to mean something.
Right, and that's where there is a solemnization that by any measure is a proper ceremony that occurs within a short window prior to the license, and then after, within the 60-day window, they manifest the intent that that solemnization be good, if you will.
Well, that sounds like the Makaja case, where the parties had the license first, then went to D.C. and had a Hindu service performed by the priest, but the next day they came back to Virginia, went to the priest's home, and evidenced that
So they'd had at the rabbi's office or somewhere cake and cookies and tea or whatever, and a little 5-minute ceremony. That would be fine.
I think that's fine, but I don't know that they even have to have the cake and the cookies. They can go together and both evidence we intend to enter into this contract of marriage. And it is the license that gives that officiant the right to take that oath, to take that evidence of intent, and to make that equal the solemnization. We're not asking the court to look behind the form of the ceremony, but there has to be some ceremony. And I think the Davison case, even though it's unpublished, is instructive of that. In the Davison case, the court said, at a minimum, both parties ought to be together in the presence of the officiant.
Well, you have at least one vote on the Supreme Court for what that means.
Can I ask you on the waiver issue that Mr. Cottrell raised earlier?
Yes.
Mr. Levick made a very strong statement earlier in trial to his counsel about he was going to live with the agreement, and he was ready to move on. Life was too short, ready to move on. Why isn't that essentially a waiver? Because there are no facts that were actually different later or learned in a different way. They were as they existed all along. So perhaps a new theory developed, but the facts were the same as they'd been when he essentially said he was ready to move on and live with the agreement.
But with waiver, Your Honor, there has to be a voluntary, intentional knowing and waiver of known rights. And you have to know at the time of the waiver what rights you're waiving.
It's not enough to know just the facts at the time. You have to know the legal consequences of what you're waiving.
Well, you have to know particularly what you're waiving and whether you are waiving you know, what is the essence of the waiver? Here, Mr. Levick did not know that he had arguments for waiver related to the nullity of a marriage. He thought he was married and that he was not waiving rights related to the formation of the document, which was supposed to form a foundation for a marital separation or divorce. And where both parties knew the same thing. Ms. McDougal was not ignorant of the facts. They both had the same facts. But he didn't know the significance of those facts. And the waiver
goes... Take it in a completely different context. Say, you know, personal injury or contract litigation. And the parties just come in and say, well, we've agreed to this particular disposition. I mean, whenever the lawyer comes up with a different theory months down the road, a different legal theory, that would then require the trial court to reopen the previously settled case?
Well, I don't think that is not what we have here.
Well,
first
how is
of
that
all,
different?
How it's different is at the time of the waiver in February of 2012, Mr. Levick did not know he had rights that arose under a nullity of the marriage. And your question suggests that he sat on rights. The evidence did not show that at court. Both parties knew the same information. What he didn't know was the significance. And the burden of proof was on Ms. McDougal. And that burden of proof is by clear, precise, and unequivocal evidence. And she did not meet that burden.
Of waiver.
I'm sorry?
Of showing a
waiver. Right. And also, waiver, like latches, and is an equitable doctrine that prevents the truth of the matter from being brought to the court. And in Virginia, there aren't any cases where the court has allowed equitable preclusive doctrines to create a marriage. And that's what would happen here. An important thing to note is that pretty much everyone else in Virginia has gotten this right since 1902.
Well, could that be because we haven't ushered in this new litigation of looking behind the license?
Well, I think as the Supreme Court in Oldfield said, our marriage laws are plain and simple. Even the humblest
citizen...
Did not
need a sympathetic ear in that form, that's for sure.
That they're easy to understand. License, every valid marriage has to be under license and solemnized. We don't have any appellate case law of this nature. It's a case of first impression. Everyone else gotten it right. You get the license. It's a two-part process. This is not a case where Virginia marriage laws need to be set on their head so that we have a second level of marriage, a different kind of marriage because of this one case. Everyone else has gotten it right. And if the court is going to, actually, it's for the legislature to determine if the law should be...
Right, to enact a different savings statute for this, maybe have a 60-day look back as well as a look forward period for solemnization or whatever.
Then what are
whatever
the people
they
during
do.
What are these people during that period? What status do they have?
Well, I mean, legislature, my point is maybe the answer is for the legislature to figure out how to handle this discrete situation.
What I would argue... There isn't a problem with the law. Maybe the court would clarify that license is, as in the Shell Oil case that defines license, it is the it confers the authority to do a thing. Maybe clarification so that it's clear for the 1% who think order doesn't matter.
Ms. Johnson, can I ask you, sort of moving on as time goes by so quickly when you're arguing here, suppose the marriage is void, for sake of my question here. If the marriage is void, why isn't the agreement necessarily perhaps still valid because Ms. McDougal relied on it to her detriment, perhaps. She, you know, didn't work because she said that, you know, she would have worked if she had thought she was not married. She wouldn't have volunteered time working for his company and not being paid if she hadn't thought she was married. That sort of thing. Why is the agreement necessarily invalid and thrown out?
Because the agreement was entered into under mutual mistake of fact. A mutual mistake as to the obligations, the personal duties and obligations that the parties had to each other. As the trial court found...
Is it a mutual mistake of fact or a mutual mistake of law?
It's a mutual mistake of fact. It's not a mutual mistake as to the law of the land or a body of law. It was a mistake as to their individual, private rights and obligations to each other. And
because the law is what the law is, but they just misunderstood the facts. Is that right?
It isn't that they... what they didn't understand is that they didn't have obligations to each other. They never created a marriage that would have enabled Ms. McDougal to get spousal support, for Mr. Levick to have visitation with her child. They didn't know that they didn't have those personal rights and obligations. And the court will treat that as a mutual mistake of fact. The case of Burton versus Hayden says that whenever a person is ignorant or to his own existing private rights, interests, duties, and liabilities, the court will treat that as a mutual mistake of fact. And they both had that same belief. The document on its face says it is to form the foundation of an agreement in the event of divorce or separation.
All right, you had a number of issues in your own appeal.
Sorry.
You had a number of issues.
Yes.
And so if you want to broach those now, we have the benefit of your briefs, and I have no doubt my colleagues have pored over them in great detail. But if there's anything you would like to highlight or touch on, I'd be happy to hear from you on those.
Are there any questions that I can answer for you as it relates to my brief? If not, I'll just highlight that two or three points in particular. One, that the court did not have jurisdiction under 2103A and 2109.
Well, the court certainly had jurisdiction to adjudicate the validity of the marriage. And the marriage, which was by license, existed until the court said it didn't exist. So what your jurisdictional argument looks back, it doesn't look from the time of filing forward, it looks back after the result of the litigation, right?
Well, our position is no marriage having a lawful existence was ever created. And whether the court declared it so or not doesn't change that. You don't have to have a court order to demonstrate that a marriage is void. But all the cases that...
No, I think the law is the opposite. You do need a court order.
If a marriage is void, it's void from its inception.
But following a judicial declaration that is so.
A judicial declaration certainly prevents the question from having to come up in subsequent litigation. But in terms of the court's jurisdiction, when the court determined that the attempted marriage was void ab initio, that relates back to to its very inception. And so these orders, which the court subsequently vacated, but only vacated back to the date of its letter opinion, leaves open the question of, were they valid from the date of entry until the date of being vacated? An order that is void ab initio is void from its inception. Ms. McDougall was never a spouse, under 2103.A.
The marriage is void ab initio. You just noted that the judge's earlier orders in this would be void ab initio. But the judge has subject matter jurisdiction to look at this, right? You're not arguing he doesn't have subject matter jurisdiction to decide whether there's a marriage here or not, right? You're just saying he doesn't have active jurisdiction, I guess, to proceed on that once he decides it was void ab initio?
I'm saying two things. One, the judge, when he vacated the orders, said the orders were void ab initio. And I'm saying an order that is void ab initio is void from the day of inception. Two, in response to your question, I am saying that the court had the potential jurisdiction to determine whether it had jurisdiction, subject matter jurisdiction, and ultimately concluded it did not have subject matter jurisdiction over the divorce case. And so the court lacked the jurisdiction to ever enter these orders. And yes, it does relate back, but that's what void ab initio means, from the time of inception.
All right, you've gone on. Did you have any questions? That it's a little past 20 minutes, and so we'll then switch and do the five-minute rebuttal times.
Thank you
for your argument.
I'd like to begin by addressing a point raised by Judge Beals, and that's the distinction between voidable and void. This was a major argument in the court below. The position that they took from the beginning was that the marriage was void ab initio so that they could then argue in a kind of syllogistic way, nothing can come of nothing. Our position is very different from that. We believe that the prohibited unions that are set forth in 20-38.1, 20-43, which amounts to bigamy, doesn't even require that a decree be entered, and 20-45.2 may or may not be prohibited. We don't know. We're still waiting on that. But those, I think you can argue this kind of argument with. But for anything else that's not self-executing, where you would need to have an adjudication, we believe it goes straight to the point that you raised, Judge Beals, which is that if the parties were married up until the time it's declared void, then of course this contract would be valid and everything else that had occurred, including all the pendency life payments and so forth. And we believe that that's the correct analysis. There was really nothing cited to that we found specifically on point that said that this kind of problem would end up with the marriage being void ab initio as opposed to the date that the decree was entered, making it void. So we believe that the proper standard is voidable rather than void ab initio. Secondly, we're urging the court today to adopt a rule of law that would be consistent with two vital public policies of Virginia. The first is upholding marriage whenever possible unless prohibited, and this one was not prohibited. And secondly, maintaining the reliability of the state register. Now, this is critical. And let me give you an example, because I think it's much more likely than what Judge Bellows was projecting as a possible harm from our side of the case. Let's take his side of the case. Let's assume that my client, instead of being a widow, had been divorced and was getting substantial alimony. And then let's assume that her former husband went to the state register, found out that she was married, and then remarried himself. And then Judge Bellows comes along and invalidates the marriage on this basis. Does she get her alimony back from her first husband? Does he get prosecuted for bigamy? Now, that's a real problem. Think about state or insurance agencies and other people who constantly look to the state marriage register. Now, we're not suggesting that if it's in the state register, it can never be attacked. But we are saying that it should be the rare day that someone can mount this kind of attack.
When and your it should be opposing on these counsel says, well, yes. The Supreme Court says, well, these laws are simple, and you know, there really hasn't been a problem for the last 100-plus years, so why do we need to bend over backwards for these folks?
Well, I think that you know the changing way in which society operates may indicate why that's the case. In other words, how many times do people go behind the register to find out exactly what went on? I would hate to think that I suddenly have a duty as a divorce lawyer.
This would certainly open that duty.
Yeah, exactly. To not only go to the state register, but then to say, well, let's hunt down whoever performed this wedding here and make sure that his foot wasn't in the water of the Potomac that's claimed by Maryland as opposed while you were standing on the bank in Virginia or something like that.
Well, is it completely irrelevant then, the fact that the document that was filed was false?
No, I don't think it was false. I think that it goes to, as a matter of fact, that's one of the things that distinguishes this from the case that she was mentioning about the marriage where they went in, they tried to get something backdated for a different date. The way that Rabbi Bieber, again, maybe he was wrong, and in that
case... Well, sure he was wrong, because he didn't marry them on that day. He had no contact with them on the day that he certified was the day that he performed the marriage.
Judge O'Brien, that's one way to look at it, but how about looking at it the way he said, which is that we started the process on December 21, and it ended when I got the license back, so that's the day that it was completed, and I signed it on that day. I'm just saying that's the way he looked at it, and that's why I say maybe he was wrong. I mean, I wish Rabbi Bieber had told my client that day, hey, look, you know, this isn't going to work, but we'll save you embarrassment here. I want you to come to my office on Monday after you get a license, and then I'll come right over here and we'll marry you privately. I wish that had happened. But I don't think that 10 years into a marriage, with all the things that have happened here, that the focus of the court should have been on these narrow constructions when there were so many different ways in which we might have been able to realize these two public policy considerations that are important. You mentioned one last thing, Judge McCullough. You said, well, they had already been through the ceremony, and then they sent it back. Are you suggesting that they had to sit down, have cake and tea, and 5 minutes in the office? Well, we have a maxim in the law. The law doesn't require a useless act. Now, if this case had turned on the fact that Mr. Leck was coming in and saying, you know what, she secretly sent that license in. I never agreed to it. I never had the intent to get married. That would be different. But it's important to realize that under the facts of this case, there was absolutely no disagreement that they wanted to be married, they took these steps to be married, they thought they were married, right up until the time it became advantageous for him to do it, to mount another attack on the agreement. Thank you.
Thank you for your argument. And now we have the SIR rebuttal. Be happy to hear from you on that.
The law is what the law is. There has to be a license. The statute is, the marriage statutes are, they are mandatory and not directory. If that changes in the future, I don't think it needs to. I don't think it should for this one instance. But what the argument is from Ms. McDougall is, again, do something different for us. There is, and putting it at the feet of the rabbi, there's nothing that the parties can do outside of themselves and the court and the law to make this be a marriage. What they're asking you to do is to create a marriage, either create it by applying equitable preclusive doctrines or the curative statute, which clearly does not apply to this case. The curative statute, 20-31, says two things that are really significant. The marriage has to be under a license. And under a license and be lawful in all other respects. You don't have either of those here. The curative statute is designed to prevent attacks on marriages where you have either a deficiency in the want of authority of the officiant, which we did not have here. Rabbi Biber had a Virginia license to marry in Virginia. The second part of the statute says if there are omissions or defects in the license. There were no omissions or defects. You can't take this case where there was no license. There was a ceremony, license, no ceremony, and cure it. It doesn't fall within the statute. You're also being asked to create a marriage.
Can I ask you on 20-151, which does refer to premarital agreements, but I wonder if you could address a little further the part C, that if a marriage is determined to be void, an agreement that would otherwise have been a premarital agreement shall be enforceable only to the extent necessary to avoid an inequitable result. Is there not an inequitable result here if she relied on the fact they were married, did certain things that she wouldn't have done otherwise, and therefore she has less money because of it, not working or working for free for his company?
I don't think so. I don't think so. The agreement is, first of all, it was not a family settlement agreement, as Ms. McDougall has alleged, that it was to possibly settle some claim for the working in the business. It was not that kind of an agreement, and they have not been able to show that it was. The language in the agreement specifically relates it to being an agreement based on a marital relationship. So it takes it out of that argument. But in terms of reliance, they both gave to this relationship, and they both invested, but they never created a marriage. And if the court decides that, the document or the lack of solemnization doesn't matter, it will go against hundreds of years of precedence on how Virginia regulates marriages, how the public policy of Virginia, even though we're in more modern times than 1902, Virginia still wants to uphold the status of valid marriages. This never rose to the level of a marriage. It was of no legal effect. It was a nullity from the very beginning.
You're right up against your 5 minutes.
Thank you so much.
We'll come down and greet counsel and take up the next case, which is Everett versus Everett.